Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Veterans in Ag podcast, brought to you by AGD Consulting. I'm your host, Mike DeSop, and here we explore the stories and insights from the military veteran and supporter communities who are leading the way for vets in agribusiness, ag tech, and agripreneurship. We swap stories, talk ag, and show how the grassroots nature of the ag community can be a natural fit for the military veteran. Today's episode brings you a story that sits right at the intersection of grit, service, and the regenerative future of our military installations. And it started with a spark, one that Angela Chaya noticed long before the Department of Defense ever cared about cattle, soil health, or regenerative grazing. As Angela put it, quote, "I saw, even in North Carolina, just this passion that Eric had for livestock, this spark about him whenever he was around livestock. There was just a really special place for him," end quote. That spark eventually became one of the most unconventional, disruptive, and frankly needed ideas to hit the national security space in decades, using regenerative livestock management as a tool to harden military installations, restore degraded training lands, and create meaningful pathways for transitioning service members. Angela joins us today to give the inside view, not the thesis version, not the policy deck, but the family level, marriage level, move across the country three times with kids in tow version of what it really took to build what is now the Regenerative Grazing Open Air Lab at Camp San Luis Obispo in California. In this conversation, you'll hear how a dairy farm kid from Wisconsin ended up shaping one of the most interesting ag meets national security projects in the country. Why livestock became a lifeline of purpose during her husband's transition from the Army Special Forces, and how their family's faith, resilience, and service-driven mindset turned a wild idea into a model that the Pentagon is now watching closely.
I grew up in a rural farming community in Wisconsin, a town called Wilton, Wisconsin. There's a population of 514 people. And so in the period that I grew up there, it was very small family dairy farming focused. From a very young age, was out. My family had a dairy farm, and so I was out there in the mix of it from as far as I can remember. Probably shortly after I was born, I was out there twice a day milking cows, whether I was actually a participant or not. But from a very young age, really took on, I would say, ownership interest in really getting involved. By the age of 6 or 7, I had my own herd of cows that I was largely responsible for. And I went and milked them at a different barn that we had down the road. And then when my parents were done at the operation right near our house, then they would come and check on me and help me finish up. But from a very young age, I took on a large responsibility associated with that. And I just really liked being out there day to day. And so whether that was milking the cows or, you know, actually I didn't really like feeding the calves. So I will say feeding the calves was not my favorite, but milking the cows, you know, in the summer, we were always baling, unloading hay. I grew up, I think I would not call anything that we did regenerative. In my upbringing, I think we were just really frugal, and that kind of led to maybe some of the more regenerative tendencies, but we certainly were operating in a more conventional way. We had a Jersey herd in those younger years of my life. And then as I transitioned maybe into my high school years and the dairy industry was doing really well, we had a significant expansion. We kind of transitioned from a Jersey herd to a Holstein herd. My family built a milking parlor and just made some really significant steps towards expansion. And I think steps towards an even more conventional approach to dairy farming. And so I kind of see some of the things that we're doing as aligning more closely to those earlier years of my upbringing and how we interacted with the cattle, as opposed to maybe my latter years in my home.
Yeah. Pardon the ignorance of the question, yeah. But Is there significance to the fact that as you guys were expanding because dairy prices were doing well, you went from Jerseys to Holstein?
Maybe there's some mindset behind a Holstein makes more milk. A Jersey has a higher cream content. And so it's just a different animal that has a different production associated with it. I think there are positives and negatives of both, but when you're looking at that time frame, it was probably just due to the price per pound of milk or per 100
Gotcha.
pounds of milk, and you got further with the Holstein. They're also a much larger animal, so they eat more. And so there's a lot of economics, obviously, that go into it. But in that area, yes, there was a significant switch from the Jersey herd to the Holstein herd, and
Gotcha.
from just a smaller scale dairy to the larger milking parlor type dairies.
I had never really, and again, this is probably just an ignorant statement, but I had never really known that, I knew that these were two different forms of dairy cattle, but I didn't necessarily know that one was more associated with cream production, which I assume, less milk by volume. But if you're looking at maybe a premium, or if you're perhaps doing smaller batches, people
Yeah.
want, a good 2 inches of cream on the top of the bottle would be amazing. But if
Yeah.
you're going to Holstein, then more milk, but more feed, and I would presume perhaps more land.
Potentially, or more equipment to generate more feed for them. So just different, I would say. And if the Jersey, maybe they're you're getting more butter out of that. And so I think we see a lot of these in our era we're in right now, these micro dairies that pop up, they tend to maybe go toward more towards the less towards the Holstein, more towards the Jersey or some of those other heritage type breeds.
In kind of the same way that cow-calf operations tend to be small or premium, not premium, but maybe our operation in Northeast Texas is a good example, right? We have 14 head, right? One bull, a handful of mama cows, a few calves this year, and a couple of two heifers, and the rest are cows. But it's a small breed, it's a small herd, right? We do some rotational grazing in between a 10-acre pasture, but they're a hardy breed. It's called a Piney Woods cattle or an Agricola, right? They look kind of like a Longhorn, right? But the horns don't go out quite as far. They're a little more, the base is a little narrower, and they don't quite grow as big. But the interesting thing is that they're super hands-off, right? They certainly don't get as big as an Angus. And they forage as much up or laterally as they do down, right? So we've got some pine trees that kind of surround the pasture, and about 3 or 4 feet up, right? All the pine needles are gone. All the oak leaves that hang down are gone. All the sweet gum leaves that hang down are gone. So they're like goats, essentially, in cattle form. But the point there was that there's an interest in this sort of breed because of its, ease of raising, if you will, right? And because of the fact that they're pretty heat tolerant, they're super low maintenance. So when you describe micro dairies popping up for certain products, my mind went to, well, perhaps there are folks that are also interested in these sort of different cow breeds in ways that they can just be more fitting for a smaller operation.
Yeah, potentially. And I've been removed from the dairy industry for, gosh, 20 years now. And so I don't want to speak on behalf of the dairy industry in a way that I, a lot's happened since then. And so anything I'm seeing, I'm not, in the weeds of like I was in my younger years. But yeah, I think there's a lot of potential as we explore different breeds of livestock for sure.
How big was the herd when you were growing up?
Oh goodness. In my younger years, we probably had 100 cows as we expanded into I mean, 100 milking cows. We obviously had all our heifers, calves that we were raising up as well. And maybe into my high school years, maybe 300, 350. I would need to fact check that with my parents though. So
Right.
don't hold me to any of that.
Is the dairy still in the family?
It's not. And so when there was, actually, shortly after I left for college, the dairy industry got hit really hard. A lot of the local family dairies in my area went out of business just because it was nearly impossible to survive. And those, I think it was like 2008 to 2010 or 2009, 10, 11, that time period. And so unfortunately, did not continue much beyond when I left the family farm.
Was it a factor of milk prices taking a hit?
It was just a significant drop in milk prices during those years, and a lot of the local small family farms just couldn't survive.
Do your parents still live on the farm or on the property? They just sold the herd.
They do.
So you get to kind of go back every now and then and sort of see, at least the land isn't gone, right?
Yeah, they did sell some chunks of the land. I will say though, we live in California, and California views compared to Wisconsin views, we don't actually get the opportunity to go back that often. But every couple of years, we try to get back and see family. But California is a desirable place, so family wants to come see us.
That makes sense. You did mention after you left home, you went to college. What did that sort of, what did you study? Where'd you go? When did the military kind of become a thing that you were thinking about?
Yeah, that's a good question. I went to the University of Wisconsin Parkside, and I initially went there on a running scholarship. I ran cross country and track in high school and continued down that pathway into college. And then I was a long distance runner, and so that long distance became even longer distance in college. And I just found myself getting really burned out, not loving running anymore. We were putting in hundreds of miles a week, and it just the love and passion that I had for it in those younger years kind of fizzled as I transitioned into those college years. And so I did that for a couple of years in college, and then decided to be done. And when I decided to be done, I also had to find a new way to pay for college. And so what better way than joining the military? And so I entered into ROTC. And through that, the National Guard had a program where they would cover the cost of tuition. I think there was also a stipend associated with it, which sweetened the deal
Okay.
for a young 20-something who was poor. And then my school didn't host an ROTC program, and so I had to travel to a different school, just 40 minutes north, Marquette University, and that's where I went through their ROTC program there and commissioned in 2012.
What were you studying?
Oh, what was I studying? I was my major was in business administration, with a focus in health, or not health. That was my master's degree, in human resources. So business with a focus in human resources.
Okay. And when, and this is another ignorant question, not being familiar with the guard type structure. When you graduated, you were commissioned?
Correct.
And then when did you get your MOS or your job?
I think it was actually a year. Well, you are assigned it upon commissioning, and so I was a 70 Bravo, with which is I think it's like Assistant Health Services Administrator or some combination of those words. And then it was a year after that that I actually went to my BOLIC and learned how to do that type of work.
Human Health Administrative Services.
Yeah, don't
Some
I've
something like that.
yeah. You can only hang on to that specific AOC for until you're a captain, and then you have to get a new AOC,
AOC.
area of concentration.
Okay,
I
okay,
think that's what it
okay,
stands for, or
okay.
MOS, same
Yeah.
deal. And so you kind of drop that one off once you hit 03, and then after that, now I have a different. So now I'm a health services, human resources, and patient administration. So I'm a 70 Echo and a 70 Fox.
And you're still in the National Guard, but you're just
No, I'm actually in the Army Reserves. So I transitioned from the Guard to the Reserves.
okay. And at this point, you've got how many years in service?
In December, I will have 16 years of service.
Okay. And so at this point, you're just going to hang on till the end, right?
Just
Yeah.
get through the last four.
Did you have any aspirations to go into human health? I mean, I know that there were some business focus with your college degree of study, but or was this just they pulled something out of the hat and you said, okay, how much say do you have in that?
Yeah, I think I had a little bit of say in it. I don't remember all of my motives exactly, but it was something that I was interested in potentially getting a master's degree in, which is what I then went on later down the road. I got my master's degree in healthcare administration. And so I tied in nicely for where I saw myself trending, and I think helped in pushing me further in that trajectory.
And when did Eric come into the mix here? Eric, your husband, for listeners who don't know this.
Yes, Eric, my husband. We met in ROTC. It was actually when he was, we're actually the same age, but I kind of took me longer to finish college and was a year behind him in ROTC. So he had actually graduated from the ROTC program. He was staying back in this, it was called a gold bar recruiter, but it was essentially he had a gap between when he was supposed to start his active duty training and when he graduated ROTC. And so in that period of time is really when we kind of connected and yeah, started seeing one another.
And did you get married shortly thereafter, or was it quite a long time ago?
No, I want to say it was 3 years after that that we got married. I would need to check my math on that.
Okay.
Yeah. But
So
we had,
when,
yeah.
no, go, no, go ahead.
I was just going to say we had a, shortly after that, he then moved to Georgia to do his initial bullock for his infantry bullock. And we did a long distance relationship from there. He moved to Washington, continued a long distance relationship, and then kind of he proposed. I moved out to Washington, but it was a year and a half, 2 years that we were kind of long distance. I stayed in Wisconsin, continued there, and he went off with the military.
Washington State, right? Not Washington, D.C.
Washington State, correct.
Okay.
Yep.
And you went back home to Wisconsin for those couple of years.
Correct.
What were
Yep.
you doing during that
Yeah,
time?
I had a really great opportunity after I commissioned. I don't remember all of the acronyms, but there was this program. It was called the Reset Program. And so at that time, folks were still deploying, or the Guard was still deploying to Iraq, Afghanistan, and the program would take the equipment that came back. One of the big things was gas masks, weapons. And so we kind of put it through a everything got cleaned, maintenance. And so I had the opportunity for a year to run that program for the Wisconsin National Guard. And so I took that opportunity. I was actually kind of being positioned to continue to take that program over. And then Eric decided to propose to me, which then made me move to Washington State. So kind of
Got
a
it.
bit of a career trajectory change.
And at that point in the National Guard, you can just sort of say, pause.
At that point in the National Guard, and so I was on, I was full time with the National Guard, and I had to submit for just a transition into the Army Reserves. And so it was probably like an 8 month paperwork process, but everyone had to sign off on it and release me into the Army Reserves. And so I was really only in the Guard for a few years before I transitioned into the Reserves.
So, a couple of years in with Eric now in Washington. So, he's probably a maybe first lieutenant.
Yes. Yeah, I think in wa yeah, shortly after I moved to Washington, he got promoted to first lieutenant. Yes. Yep.
And then there was maybe a deployment or two before he kind of transitions into his B billet role.
Yeah, he was so sad about this. He missed the deployments. And so it was like his platoon had just gotten back from a deployment. And so he actually didn't get to deploy as he arrived to his unit in Washington State, which gave him some heartburn, but he did have opportunities to deploy with once he transitioned into the Third Special Forces Group.
Okay. And I know that there was some time there before he kind of comes into the Naval postgraduate school type role. What was that time like for you, when he's deployed and he's super busy? And I mean, how are you sort of filling your days at that point?
Yeah, so we moved to North Carolina, and North Carolina is where we started having our kids. And so, honestly, I think 2 to 3 weeks after we arrived in North Carolina is when our first daughter was born, and so we didn't waste any time have
Naturally.
getting kids settled in a new state. And so yes, and he really rolled right into the Q course, or the qualification course, which is the 2 year special forces training pipeline. So we got there, our daughter was born, he started the course, just a lot happening all at once. And then kind of that continued. We continued having kids every 2 years until just 2 years ago. And during that time, though, Eric and I have been really diligent about being involved in marriage ministry. And so we early on went through a marriage program, and then felt led, or I guess called, not so much led, called to continue to lead that program at our local church. We remember, showing up to them, telling them, hey, there's this really great curriculum called Reengage. Someone should lead it. And they're like, when are you guys going to start?
Yeah, right.
And we were like, we've never led anything. We barely attended groups at church. And so, God doesn't always call the equipped, he equips the called. And so we really felt like that's what he did with us in that marriage ministry space. And so through that, though, we had an incredible community around us. And so, as you say, how did I cope with, deployments, or, just that really demanding schedule of Eric's special forces career? That community that was around us through that marriage ministry was just really, really incredible. I think all the way up until the point, Eric had a pretty significant injury. He was hospitalized for a significant amount of time. And so through that time, that was actually way more challenging than any deployment that he was on, or being away. But through that time, that community that was around us just, I mean, they were, for like a period of 6 months, I don't even know how many meals we made. They brought us meals, they mowed our grass, they packed up our trailer to move from North Carolina to California, helped us, get our house in order to move out of it. And so I think that would have been a really challenging time with his career, having kids, expanding our family, if it wasn't for that just really incredible community that we were surrounded by and that I had the opportunity to be supported by while he was in and out.
Was that re-engage curriculum focused primarily on military spouses within your church?
No, I mean, our church was largely a military population. There was also some local folks too. And so we had the opportunity to work with a lot of military couples, but it's for anyone who's married. And so we always say whether, you would rate your marriage a one and you want to get to two, or you're, a nine and you want to get to 10. So good to great, or, just really in a rough place and we need to get just a little bit better. It's applicable. And so we continue to. Just last night, we actually led our re-engage group virtually because we're not there right
Wow.
now. And so we're continuing to kind of refine ourselves and do that preventative maintenance on our marriage and just being really intentional with one another and our time together.
The curriculum is out there, but you've got to go through a process to which you can communicate it. Is that right?
Correct. And so, it's hosted a church here in Texas, actually created at Watermark Church in Dallas, Texas, created the curriculum. And so they churches can partner with them to offer the curriculum. And so it's not something that I can go on Amazon and buy the curriculum for. It's entering through their pathway, and they provide just incredible resources to churches who are interested in launching their curriculum. And so it makes it really easy to get started. As the military has moved us around, we've had the opportunity to start re-engage at three different churches, which has been such a blessing to us, and to be able to serve that community and expand the curriculum to those communities. But they make it really easy, user-friendly to get that curriculum launched off the ground.
Is it denomination agnostic, so to speak?
It's a Christian curriculum. And so, but yes, denominations, there's all different Christian denominations apply at their churches.
What comes up often in folks that I have that grew up on a farm, specifically a dairy farm, right, where it's twice a day, 365, right?
Yeah.
They either can't wait to get as far from it as possible, right? Or it's so, or it's just been so cornerstone for them that it's always sort of there, and there's always this little inkling, especially in your case where the dairy is no longer a part of the family. When you're now in North Carolina and you're in California, Eric's super busy. You've got this marriage ministry. You've got several kids now. Is there always in the back of your mind, or is that like so far gone that you're just not even thinking about it at this time?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think leaving the family farm when I graduated high school, I am not interested in continuing that. I think my family was hopeful that I would want to continue the family farm, but I just didn't really see that as being, obviously it was challenging financially for them, and so I didn't see that as like a viable financial pathway for myself. And really, when we moved to North Carolina and we got this small slice of land out there, and Eric, first it was, chickens and pigs and turkeys, and then once he wanted to get cows, I was like, I guess we can get cows. It was so funny. I remember early on, I think it was we maybe had two cows at that point, and his parents came to visit, and they're like, it's so nice that Eric's letting you get these cows, thinking. And I was like, this is actually all Eric's idea. I'm here, I'm supporting him, but he was the one who actually wanted to bring these cows home. But I think what was really cool about it is as we started kind of getting more livestock and seeing how we could apply some of these regenerative principles, that's where I started getting really interested. I started going back to all the way from when I was a little kid and we were just really frugal and didn't have much money. And so being able to kind of think outside of the box in some of our approaches. And so really being able to kind of pull from some of that period of life and apply some of those principles. And really seeing how the land responded to that is where I started, that kind of was re-sparked for me. And so I think it was completely dead for a very long time. And then
Got it.
just kind of being out there and then also raising the girls in that type of environment was really appealing for me. I love the work ethic that developed in me and being able to kind of emulate something similar. Obviously, the girls aren't going to be out there with their own herd of cows, milking them at 6, 7 years old. But I would love to be able to emulate some of, the impact that had on me at a young age with our girls.
As Eric's out in California now. So the homestead started in North Carolina.
Correct. Yep.
And then as you guys went to California, was there an opportunity or an inkling to try to pull some of that with you in some way? And what did that look like at first?
Our initial plan was we're going to go to California, go to the Naval Postgraduate School, and as soon as we can get back to North Carolina, we kept our property there. We even actually kept some of the livestock that my sister cared for us. But our plan was to get to back to North Carolina as quickly as possible. And God just had a different pathway for us, and so we've just been being obedient and responsive to where he's guiding and directing us. We never imagined that we would be able to work with livestock cattle in California. And so just that, that we're out there doing that now is just quite a testament to, God. Like we can think that we have a way and we know what's going to happen next, but God's plans are always bigger than ours.
Do you still have the farm and the herd in North Carolina?
We don't have any livestock. Just this last year, we actually got rid of the last ones, but we still have the property and our house there. And I
But
think we'll probably hang on to that.
you've been in California now for a few years.
Yes, since 2022.
Yeah. So I've heard obviously the story from Eric about how the ARGOL program, so ARGOL, Regenerative Grazing Open Air Lab, right? How that came to fruition. And it's an interesting story about him going into his advisor about, I want to do this thing with cows, and having no idea as to whether or not this his advisor was even open to it until he walked into her office and it was covered with cows on the wall, But I want to hear it from your perspective as he's batting around this idea of a thesis that's in the past just so far out of the traditional norm at a defense education school like the Naval Postgraduate School to use livestock or ag in some national security way. How are you, what's that time like for you as Eric is wrestling with just this different pathway potentially?
Yeah, and so I saw even in North Carolina just this passion that Eric had for livestock, and so just this spark about him whenever he was around the livestock, talking about the livestock, doing anything associated with the livestock, that was just a really special place for him. And so I knew that he had that passion, that interest, and so from the moment that we arrived at the Naval Postgraduate School, we knew that he would have to select a thesis topic. He was kind of originally going down this pathway of, a purpose statement. There are so many folks in his area specifically that leave the service, and, that position that they held is their, really only purpose, and they really struggle with what's their purpose after they leave the military, leave the special forces. And so that was his focus. And I'm like, Eric, that's really important. That sounds really interesting, but I really think that there is, you are borderline obsessed with cows. And I think that it would be so enjoyable if you just got to spend the next 2 years researching and writing about cows. And so I think he, for a really long time, thought that that w wouldn't be something that anybody at the Naval Postgraduate School would be excited about. He and I spent a lot of time talking about, how there could be this tie-in to national security, and how we, steward our installations. And so, I found myself during that time, I think, doing a lot of trying to convince him down this pathway, just knowing that he would have a much more time or a much more enjoyable time in writing and building out his thesis if the focus was cows. Not that the purpose statement wasn't important, but I just saw him as having a more enjoyable time in this academic setting if the focus could be cows. And so, again, we just go back to how God has been, guiding and directing us through this whole process, and just the fact that he walked into this lady's office and there's cows all over. The moment that he walked out the door, I knew he was meeting with her, and I said, Eric, please just talk to her about cows and the national security thing like we've been talking about. And anyway, so just that, God knew that he needed that little extra nudge of the cow pictures all over the office. So just, yeah.
So he comes back from that meeting, and what's that like then? Like,
Yeah, I think it was just relief for us, knowing that, there was support that he could focus on, something that he was really, really interested in. I don't vividly remember, the next steps there, but I think what was really interesting at the Naval Postgraduate School is we kind of thought that they were just kind of put him, in the closet in the corner and be like, it's great that you're gonna study this, but we don't want anyone to know that this crazy guy's over here studying cows. And so we thought that, whenever anyone came to the university, it was going to be, Eric, you just be quiet over there, don't share with anyone. But it was any general, admiral, any distinguished visitor that came to the Naval Postgraduate School, they were actually saying, Eric, can you give this individual, a 5 to 7 minute briefing on your project? And so it just got this attention that we didn't think it was going to get, which was really incredible to see that people were actually interested in this really out of the box concept. And so just the support that came from the Naval Postgraduate School was really incredible.
I want to go down that road of what that support has been like
Yeah.
to date. Before I do that, though, just for listeners who aren't familiar with the nuts and bolts of the program, can you give us a rundown of what it is, how much you're
Yeah.
managing now, what your goals are, how long is the program, et cetera?
Yeah. And so I'll kind of take one step back to those
Please.
distinguished visitors that were coming to the Naval Postgraduate School. There was one of those, Honorable Rachel Jacobson, from Army Installations, Energy and Environment, who was really interested in Eric's project and was interested in supporting the initial efforts at, she just said we had to find a base that was interested in applying the regenerative principles. And so lo and behold, we found Camp San Luis Obispo that happened to already have livestock on it. And so what we were able to do then is work with a local rancher who had the livestock on Camp San Luis Obispo, which is 2,500 acres. And we have roughly 140 cow-calf pairs that we're managing here. And so what we've been able to do is work with this local rancher and just change the management style of the livestock on Camp San Luis Obispo. And so we are out there moving the livestock typically once a day. Every once in a while, we'll get a little bit more aggressive than that and do a couple moves a day. But we're out there moving these 140 cow-calf pairs to a new slice of grass on Camp San Luis Obispo every day and have just had a significant amount of support from the rancher. He is one of our biggest advocates in this space, which was just really incredible. He is was very conventional, and so this the thought that he would even be interested in or willing to let us manage his livestock in this very different way, very different for him, but also just very different for the region that we're in California as well. And so yes, we are out there in the day-to-day at Camp San Luis Obispo, kind of creating this checkerboard with the cows around the base.
When or how did you begin to get more involved?
Yes, that's a really good question. So I think kind of in the background, as Eric was even, working through his studies at the Naval Postgraduate School, I was kind of in the background, I would say. Anything that he was submitting or working on, we spent a lot of time talking about those, and so was very involved in the concept of, what he was proposing and what was going to happen at Camp San Luis Obispo. I think when we actually got there, I became much more involved than I anticipated originally I would be, not necessarily in a bad way, but just kind of how I had painted it in my mind. The terrain is really challenging out there. And so you see, this is a picture of our, where we are behind me. And so it's really hilly in some areas. I wouldn't go so far as to call it mountainous, but it felt mountainous in the early
Yeah,
stages. It
right.
feels a little flatter now, but it was just really challenging to fence. And we were maybe taking a bit of a militant approach to our regenerative grazing efforts. And so, if we calculated what the stock density should be, and it said we had to put them on 6 acres, we were very stringent about that. And so if that meant we had to hike up the side of a mountain and put in posts and do it all by hand, on foot, that's what we were doing. Since then, we've taken a little bit of a different approach, and we've decided if we can't safely drive on an area, we're not going to fence it, or we're going to, fence around it. And so that might mean we might want to give them 6 acres, but instead they're going to get 12 because that's what we can safely fence without having to go on foot or without having to go on foot for the majority of it. And so it was very labor intensive in the beginning, and I think it's because we were maybe trying to be too stringent about our we weren't being as maybe adaptive or flexible as we needed to be or should have been during that time period. And so that meant that it was kind of all hands on deck in figuring out how to fence on this really challenging terrain. The soil is also it was very compact, very hard, and so just very different than what we were doing on our little homestead in North Carolina. The terrain's different, soil's different. Climate actually is much more nicer here in California. But it was just a lot more labor intensive starting off than I think we had envisioned in our mind, just I think largely due to the terrain out here. Since then, we've gotten a lot more comfortable. The hills do flatten a bit as you get familiar with them, and we know where we can drive safely, where we can't drive safely. And so it's just really sped up our day-to-day processes out there. But yes, just by default, and we needed more hands on deck when he started, my hands and were part of that.
We're on that. I'm thinking to myself, you're a wife, you're a mother, you're a regenerative rancher. There's going to be listeners who are thinking, how that you're managing a household. How the heck do you do this, right? What does the day-to-day life look like for you, such that you can structure all of these different pieces and still be as involved with Eric in the way that you are?
Yeah, that's a good question. Also, I wonder that some days myself. We also homeschool our girls, and so that was one of
As
the
do
changes.
we, yeah.
One of the changes as we moved to Camp San Luis Obispo was that we started homeschooling the girls, which that had been on our heart for a while, but really making that transition. And I would say that first year was really challenging for us. We were trying to figure out, all of their different and unique learning styles. And it was just really hard. I would say as we have just entered into our second year of that, it was like the first year we were in all of those ways as we were getting this project launched, and that homeschool element, we were just surviving, quite frankly. And as we've entered into this second year, we have a good bit of structure to our days. And so we spend Everyone wakes up early in our house most of the time. And so we spend a good portion of the early to mid-morning just focused on our homeschooling efforts. So that's actual workbook curriculum with the girls. And then mid-morning, we break out and we go out and support, on the ground fencing, moving cattle. I think what's been really unique with having the girls out there with us as we're going through those day-to-day motions is not only do they get to be involved in that, there are some times where we can be moving really fast and not slowing down and really soaking in and observing as much as we should. And so I think having them out there is sometimes this unfair advantage that we don't always recognize where they're helping us to slow down. We stop and we are, talking about the praying mantis and, how those are coming back and, what a pray. Anyway, so we get to have like a little mini study on praying mantises as we're out there interacting with a praying mantis. And so I think it's a really unique learning environment for them, but we're also, and every moment of it isn't, rainbows and butterflies. There are certainly someone, melting down, or someone doesn't want to be out there, it's cold, someone's hungry. That is a very realistic part of our day-to-day. We carry lots of snacks with us. But largely, just the opportunity to be together as a family, whether we're, doing actual work out there, or we're, sitting and just observing either where we grazed or where we're going into. That's what we spend kind of the mid portion of our day. And then, early afternoon, retreating back, prepping dinner, those types of things. And so I don't know if that's exactly answering your question, but we try to be very homeschool focused, workbook in the morning, and then anything in the midday afternoon is, hands-on out there experiences.
It does answer my question, and I think it sheds light into a common misconception with homeschooling folks, is that either the executors of the homeschooling program, right, like new parents, or those who are looking at the program from the outside and saying, yeah, I mean, if you're not doing school from 8 to 3, then you're not doing school, right? And you're like, well, if you actually add up the amount of time that a 7 or 8 a.m. program till 3 o'clock is actually spent doing school, really only equates to a few hours. And if you can condense that into a 9 to noon type structure at home, then you're actually getting the same actual amount of school without all the transitions and stuff in the middle. And
For
so
sure.
that's a reality, right? And then you've got this whole second half of the day in many respects to do all of the kind of opportunistic hands-on type approaches that you just described with having the girls out, for several hours a day out there, and it's you have how many girls? Kids total, I should say.
Yeah, four. All girls,
Four.
though. Yes,
Okay.
four.
I guess I thought there was a boy mixed in there. Just we've got four boys.
Oh,
So
wow.
we're on the other end of that spectrum. Okay. I didn't realize you guys had all four girls. Okay.
They want a brother, but we remind them that we don't get a say in that.
That's true. That's true. Are you guys thinking there might be
I don't think so. Four is a lot of kids.
It is. It is. That ship has sailed for us. My oldest is now 9. So you're like,
Yeah, that's ours. So we're 9 to 2 is our spread.
ah, you're on the young end though. Mine are 9 and
Oh.
older.
Oh, okay.
Am
Okay.
I? Yeah. Yeah. At 9 to 2 and adding another one in there would be tough.
Yeah.
That's a tough one.
Yes, I think we're maxed out.
I want to ask. So, my wife Katie and I we're close. We've been married almost 18 years. We love doing things together, but they're different things, right? She doesn't have the same interests. She doesn't have a lot of the same interests that I do. And so I want to ask what it's like for you getting to spend all this time with Eric in these places that you both share an incredible passion for. Is it, I mean, I know it's not all sunshines and roses, right? But is it more sunshine and roses than it is like fighting about, well, I would do it this way versus how, he's suggesting doing it? Like, what's that opportunity and interaction actually like?
And I think kind of going back to what I was sharing about that re-engaged marriage curriculum that we've been involved in, that's been a really good, and if you would ask any of our re-engaged groups that we've led over the past over the past year, they would say Eric and Angela's on farm, what the fencing looks like is a constant thing that's brought up in group as they're sharing their different struggles from week to week. And so I would say early on, that was a challenge. It was even a challenge to the point of like just managing schedules together. And so when we were in North Carolina, for example, I mean, Eric would leave for the day before anyone woke up, and he would come home, maybe at dinner, bath time, bedtime. And then kind of the next day would be the same. And so it was a lot of, he just wasn't there a lot of the time. And so as we had this, transition to Monterey where he entered into academia, we got more of his time. And so that was kind of like the first step, slow transition to more time together, incorporating schedules together. And then as we moved to San Luis Obispo, it was a day in and day out together. And so I think that transition helped us significantly, but I also think those tools that we've developed through this re-engaged curriculum have been really helpful. And I think the fact that we continue to go through that marriage curriculum together has been helpful in helping us see, where we need to improve in our communication skills with one another. And so we certainly do, I think early on, he had an idea of how we should fence an area. I had an idea of how we should fence an area, and they were very different. And so, coming to a place of understanding and agreement and way forward, that was challenging on certain days. That's an area that we've identified how we can improve there, and try to play that out in the day-to-day. I would say that we've had a significant improvement in that area over the past year. But it's just really figuring out how he communicates, how I communicate, and how to kind of meet in the middle and mesh those together in a way that makes sense to both of us. And so to this point of, shared understanding where we both, understand how the other one is thinking and working. But that wasn't instant. It took time, and was challenging at moments. But I would like to say that we're improving in that day-to-day interaction out there.
Blessing though, right? To go through the necessary trials that it takes to get to a point where you can spend 6, 8 hours a day with your husband or wife, and have it be productive and enjoyable, right? And in a way that, you know, many spouses just don't get the opportunity to do, especially or in God's country as well,
Right.
right? That's just you don't take that opportunity lightly, I can tell. And I think that that's just a really wonderful space God has given you to be able to figure those things out, right? And you know, when you're at 40 years, it just, you know, you're going to be a different couple than if you didn't have to go through those trials and opportunity, you know, at 10 or 15 years, however long you guys have been married.
Yeah, and I think that we're at the we say this regularly, actually, where it's if we had to go back to the lifestyle that we had in North Carolina, that like as a family, that would be really challenging. And even for our girls, that would be really challenging to they get a lot of time with their dad, which is just so
Right.
special and such a
Yeah.
blessing. And so it is a blessing for me, but it's also a blessing for them to get that day-to-day interaction with him that they quite frankly wouldn't be getting in the setting that we were previously in.
I mean, from so my oldest is 15 and he's been homeschooled since he was 4, and then all of the other ones have been homeschooled behind him. He was born in 2010. And I left the military in 2014. And so most of what he remembers is dad around. Same thing with the younger three, right? They don't really remember much different. And so they because they don't have prior experience to it, don't fully appreciate yet what it's like to have mom and dad around all the time, right? In fact, it's sometimes a huge pain. Right, when they think about having their parents just everywhere and in everything, I hope that, you know, when they get on the other side of this, they'll realize how unique that opportunity is, especially to have dad around, right? Because I also work from home today, you know, and so, you know, you won't really know until you talk to them when they're adults what that was like, but
We have our second, her name's Emmeline. She is dad's sidekick all the time. So anything he's doing, she wants to be right there next to him doing it. And so there will be times where he has a meeting that on the base that she isn't able to attend, or sometimes he has to go back to Monterey for some meetings. And it is so tragic for her whenever he's going away. And I'm like, girls, what you don't recognize is like this hour meeting that he's going to attend. We used to not see him for the entire day when he was in or newer in North Carolina. And so it's yes, this different yes, hopefully they appreciate it, but also maybe have some perspective of that that's not quite the norm in most situations.
I do want to ask you about the interest lately that the program, the Argo program, has been getting. What kinds of things and conversations have you all been having, and why do you think that those have been occurring so frequently in the last fill in the number months or year or two?
Yeah, I think early on, and I, part of this could have been that we were just so focused on surviving the day to day and getting these cows moved to a new slice of grass every day, or forage, I guess, not just grass. And so we were very focused on, what's happening today, what's happening tomorrow, and looking much beyond that was kind of challenging. I think this administration is really interested in the things that we're doing. Eric's had the opportunity to have just a lot of really exciting connections, meetings, discussions with folks who are, we didn't necessarily know or think that they would be on board with expanding his project, but there's actually a lot of interest and buzz around his project expanding. And so I think of late in the last couple months, that's increased even more, and more. I think we were making some really significant steps towards expanding his project to additional bases, and then the government shut down. And so we're just waiting for the government to turn back on so we can start engaging in those conversations again. But it was kind of, we hit this August, September timeframe, just a lot of interest, excitement about the project, and so we are excited to re-engage in those conversations once the government gets turned back on.
Why do you think that that interest has been so strong so recently?
Yeah, we've had some. So former Senator Kyrsten Sinema came out, and she visited in mid-summer timeframe, and was just really impressed with what we're doing and the resilience of our installations by applying these regenerative practices, kind of closing some of those food system loops. And so she just saw a lot of potential in the project, and has been a really incredible advocate with bringing other folks of interest into the space. And so I think that is really what jump started the interest, and then a lot of that has just been organic with as more folks hear about this. I think at the same time, we're here at this attending this Farmer Veteran Coalition conference right now. Like I said, where Peter Bick did a private screening of the documentary that he created about what we're doing. And so we're at this kind of culmination of all of these that visit with that former Senator Kyrsten Sinema, plus Peter Bick's documentary coming out here shortly. And so I think just this culmination of all of these events kind of happening at once and interest being garnered. Just the timing. And so that's one of the things that we've been, we keep saying if God wants us to expand, it will. He'll create the right connections. And there's sometimes where we're like, it's not moving as fast as we would like it to. And so just kind of reminding of, God's timing is the best timing. And when we try to kind of interject ourselves in that, we can kind of cause more harm than good.
What does the future of that program look like, in your opinion?
Yeah, we see it expanding to, or the plan right now is to expand to five installations over the next 5 years. I guess Camp San Luis Obispo is included in that five number. And so three of those installations being right here in California on the Central Coast. And so there's 200,000 acres just on the California Central Coast that we could. Within 90 minutes from one base, the furthest north to the furthest south base, really be able to impact just in this specific area. Obviously, there's some of our bases dwarf that acreage, but in the very near term, seeing that impact in the expansion to these bases here. And then we have a lot of different interest from other bases. And as we've kind of engaged with more folks, it becomes more of, can you do this on my base? We're interested in this type of management. What would that look like? How would we get a program like this launched? And I think one of the long poles in the tent have been the people to be able to do this. And so managing regeneratively is kind of it's a small population right now who are regenerative land managers or regenerative grazers. And then kind of taking that population even further to say, managing regeneratively on a Department of War installation. And so it's different. Like it's not equivalent to on your own private property or leased property running an operation. There's a lot of we need to be working with the environmental team, with the range operations, DPW, making sure that our grazing plan is, there in agreement with, where we're grazing, that we're not going to be disrupting any training. And so there's a lot of stakeholders on the installation that I think you're typical regenerative operation wouldn't even have to think of. And so our goal is to be able to get more folks trained in specifically regenerative grazing on a Department of War installation, and then being able to replicate what Eric's doing here at other installations by having these individuals that are trained in doing this. And so that's where we see a lot of potential and opportunity as his project expands, but also, having some quality control over the folks that we have as we're expanding this program on other installations. One one small incident could really erode trust. So if we expand to an installation, we place someone there who's not quite ready to take on that management interaction, that could be really detrimental to the projects. And so just making sure that we have people as we expand who are well vetted and well qualified to be able to step into that role and take on kind of what Eric's built at Camp San Luis Obispo, being able to replicate that at other installations will be really critical, the people element of it.
People being the long pole in the tent, and then the quality of those people. You're using the Skills Bridge program now, and your own operation is the training venue. Is the intent, as you scale or move to five different installations over the next 5 years, is it to continue to use the Skill Bridge program, or are you thinking about building your own curriculum that modulates in between different installations? How are you thinking about ensuring that the quality of that stays intact?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think we're still working out some of the finer details of that. I think the SkillBridge program is a really incredible way to have a 3 to 6 month interview with someone. And so we can really assess their skill sets at the end of that SkillBridge program. Are they ready to go and manage an installation or the grazing at an installation? No, but we have a really good idea of their skill set and their potential skill set. And so I think that's where we see the real benefit of, being able to take someone who's interested in that and really take them to kind of the next level and make sure that we are producing that highest quality person.
Five installations over the next 5 years puts Eric past traditional 2 or 3 year duty station. What does that look like? How do you think that pans out?
That's a really good question. And we're still I think we're still figuring some of that out. It's just been incredible. Again, just how God has directed us through all of this and kind of provided in areas that we didn't think that he he was going to show up, but yet continues to have that provision for us. And so we're in, or Eric is in discussion with the Naval Postgraduate School, and does this program stay nested within the Naval Postgraduate School? Does it live somewhere else in the future? And so what exactly does that look like? I don't really know. We were having a lot of those conversations before the shutdown as well. And so hoping to pick those up once things get back rolling on the government side. But we anticipate that he'll continue to be able to oversee the expansion of this project program and has just received a lot of favor in being able to do that and quite frankly support in being able to do that from higher up folks in his chain of command.
Whether that's in uniform or out of uniform.
Yes, we anticipate potentially in uniform, but we'll see. And again, just trusting in what God's plan for us.
Angela, this has just been such a true pleasure. Having heard Eric's perspective on this, and knowing some foundation for the program, and then just getting a totally different, the same picture, but through a totally different set of lenses, has been really interesting. So thank you so much for your time, especially in the middle of a conference like this, and for your candor and the articulate way in which you describe these things. So, but I want to give you the opportunity to have the last word, essentially, right? Is there, well, first of all, two last words, right? Are there things that you are trying to attract attention to right now, or programs that you won't potentially want to shed light on, websites? Or, I mean, if there's any of that, feel free to sort of share that now.
It's a good question. I think specifically the SkillBridge program, which we've already talked about, is there's a lot of benefit for us to have folks out there. It's been so rewarding to be able to see. We just had Lorian, our first Skillbridger, who came through, just graduated last Friday. He was a Marine from Camp Pendleton. And so being able to see him come in, not having any experience in agriculture or really even knowing if this was, the trajectory that he wanted in his life, and now having this passion, I mean, he was out there every day staying later so he could learn how to rope cattle on his own. And so just being able to see that transformation in those Skillbridge folks who come through, who, didn't really have an interest in agriculture or experience in agriculture, and then being able to see them now have this passion and drive to really jump into agriculture. And as we talk about, the average rancher is, I think it's 67 and aging. And so being able to take this, population of folks who are getting out of the service, even if they've been in the service 20 years and are getting out of the service, that's still significantly lower than that, average rancher age. And so just really being able to bring this younger generation into sparking interest in being able to bring this younger generation into the farming community, is just a really incredible opportunity, to be able to be a part of.
What you just heard isn't a story just about cows and grass. It's a story about what happens when grit meets grace, when military discipline meets regenerative thinking, and when a family says yes to something way bigger than themselves, even when it means moving across the country, homeschooling four daughters from the field, and learning to fence on terrain that feels like a mountain. Angela's statement early in this conversation is one that I often fall back to, quote, "God doesn't always call the equipped. He equips the called," end quote. That's the whole story right there, right? A dairy kid from Wisconsin who thought she was done with ag. A marriage ministry that taught them how to work side by side when the stakes were high. A special forces officer with a thesis idea so unconventional that it could have been laughed out of the room. But it wasn't. And a family that chose to lean into uncertainty, trust the process, and move livestock across 2,500 acres in California training land, one slice of grass at a time. And now, the Pentagon's watching. Bases are calling. Veterans are transitioning into a pathway that didn't exist several years ago. And a model that started with a thesis and a handshake is becoming a blueprint for how we steward the places where our warriors train. Angela, Eric, and their whole family are proof that the best ideas don't always come from the expected places. They come from people willing to do the work, stay humble, and trust that if it's supposed to be, it will be.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the Vets and Ag podcast, brought to you by AGD Consulting. If you enjoyed this episode and think other military veterans and supporters would benefit from these insights and stories, please give us a review and share on social media. You can also find previous episodes and learn more about AGD Consulting by visiting our website. Finally, if you have any recommendations of future guests who are military veterans or supporters leading the way in agribusiness, ag tech, or agripreneurship, please send them our way. I'm your host, Mike Dessau, and until next time, stay frosty.